Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Koh, your host, and thank you for tuning in today with Jamal Yogis. I am so excited for you to check out this episode. I loved talking to this guy. He is a talented author. This is his third book. All Our Waves, Our Water is just coming out. I think it literally is live the week that we are releasing this episode. Check it out on Amazon. You can find it in bookstores. He's also the author of Saltwater Buddha and The Fear Project. He is an award-winning journalist who's written for ESPN, The Washington Post, Surfer's Journal, Chicago Tribune, San Francisco Magazine, and many, many others. He is an acclaimed author and shares with us today his story. This new book is really a memoir. It is based on his journey. Very, very, very compelling story with lots of life lessons that we go through in this just really deep, interesting, and personal conversation. I hope you love it as much as I did. You can, again, find him at Jamal, J-A-I-M-A-L, Yogis, like yoga, Yogis.com. All Our Waves. You can find all his stuff. That's JAIMALYOGIS.com. And everything again will be on my site. You can find it there. Check out his book. I read it. Really beautiful, beautiful writer. Thank you so much for tuning in. Welcome to The Art of Authenticity. Today we have Jamal Yogis joining us. Hey, Jamal, how are you?
Doing great, Laura. Thanks.
Coming from us all the way from San Francisco, telling me about the weather there while I'm in Chicago, which I'm still slightly bitter about, but
I won't rub it in.
So Jamal and I were having such a great pre-interview chat that we decided we have to stop and save it because we would take up the whole hour just enjoying ourselves. I'm so happy to have met you and to have the opportunity to chat. Jamal just finished a new book. He has a book called All Our Waves, Our Water. I just wanted to start with that title because I don't know, mostly titles are a little more self-explanatory and that one is just so poetic and beautiful. Why that title specifically? What does that mean for you?
So I was trying to figure it out myself. I remember the conversation I had with my publisher about it and she said, I don't know what this title means, but I have to have this book. And I thought, well, then it's worked.
That's right. That's kind of how I felt about it. I'm like, I love it. And I'm trying to, at the same time, I want to keep coming back to it to figure out what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, it does have a philosophical grounding in really this idea that a lot of mystical traditions hit on and some philosophical ones as well of just the fact that there has to be a unifying principle and that all phenomenal reality has a sort of, you know, if you break it down to its basic parts and keep going basic, more basic, there's going to be a sameness there on the ground. And I always loved the metaphor that a lot of philosophers and spiritual teachers have used with waves, where they'll say, you know, for Buddha nature or God, like we're all like waves and our true nature or enlightened nature is the sea. And you can break that down with any kind of things that have a beginning and an end or a birth and a death, mm-hmm. that there is this sort of underlying source. And all our waves are water was, I thought, just a nice poetic way of honoring that tradition. And I lived in a Buddhist monastery after high school and was very intrigued by this idea. And also the paradox of it that, okay, well, there is this sameness and, you know, maybe you and I are one on some level, mm-hmm. but here we are, you know, you're in Chicago and I'm in San Francisco and, you know, I have no idea what you're thinking and, you uh-huh. know, how are we really all one? And how does that play out and how is it helpful in everyday life? You know, how does it help when you get a parking ticket? How is it helpful when you're trying to figure out who you are? And I wanted to explore that through, you know, the only way I really know how, which is writing and telling stories. And so that's kind of the jumping off point, which it seems like kind of it should be an end point, but I decided to jump off there and then see, you know, where basically talk about how I had thought about that and over many years. And so that's the gist.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes great sense. And it is, it's this beautiful paradox, and I love the idea. And yet, right, it's like I struggle with it at the same time of what that exactly means, but there's something about it that rings so true. And you've written, you know, several books, Saltwater Buddha, the last one. What a memoir, right? I was sort of struck, why that style of book at this point in your life?
Yeah, so Saltwater Buddha was actually my first one, which came out almost, 8 or 9 years ago. And then I went to a different style, which was a little bit memoir, a little bit journalistic reporting, the Fear Project.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I get those backwards?
No worries. That is makes perfect sense, because All Our Waves Are Water basically is sort of a follow-on to Saltwater Buddha, and the Fear Project was in the middle of them. And the Fear Project was a different take, where I was basically accruing a lot of information from neuroscientists and psychologists, and then, you know, weaving it together in a sort of journalistic format. But anyway, the way I became a memoirist at 25, which was an odd thing to do, was I stumbled into it. I got out of journalism school. I wanted to be, you know, political or environmental journalist, and was, you know, trying to get all my articles out there, and it was going okay. And I was got a nice sort of beginning staff writer position in here in San Francisco. But I've always been a big surfer too. And as I said, I lived in a Buddhist monastery after high school. And so I had this, I almost became a monk. And then I decided not to be a monk and decided I needed a job and all that. But then when I became a journalist, this whole monk sort of like seeker part of me, I was like, I can't let anybody know about that, because I'm going to want to be taken seriously. And I don't know, at some point along the line in the first year, I decided it felt like I was living a lie a little bit, and like I was hiding the most important part of myself. So I wrote this little piece, and I was scared to death to do it, about surfing and how it's a form of meditation for me. And I wrote it for, I think, Shambhala Sun magazine, that's now the Lion's Roar, a little Buddhist not that little, it's a national magazine. And I expected nobody to really notice in the journalistic world, but it struck a chord, kind of buzzed around the internet, got republished in a bunch of places. And I was like, of course, like the article I got paid $100 to write is like my most successful article ever. And
because it was a truthful one, right? Like, I think that happens so frequently when we finally get the courage to speak our truth, that people resonate with it.
Exactly. I mean, most of the reporting I was doing, I was really just regurgitating other people's opinions. And that plays a role in democracy and all that. But this was something different. That was like some energy here. And so I think by another magazine republished it, and they said, do you want anything written in your bio? And by that point, I was starting to see like this was fun to be myself. And I said, well, say I'm writing a book about this. And then a publisher contacted me literally like days later and said, we want to publish that book. And so I decided I didn't want to sort of do it in a didactic way, where I was, you know, I was clearly still just figuring out what life means, and I didn't want to be a know-it-all guru, but I decided, well, I could tell it in stories. And so that was how Saltwater Buddha came about. And yeah, but I never would have expected I would be doing, you know, working on memoirs.
Yeah. Well, you have this incredible story. I mean, your life is, you know, people talk about doing the things that you've done. I mean, living in a Buddhist monastery right after school, it's like you actually did these things. So there's a lot of content there to write on. A lot of your book reflects on a heartbreak that happened between you and a early relationship, but it feels like it's this sort of broader search for self that I got the sense that as I was reading your book, that there's like the way in which there's a central theme of this heartbreak, but there's this theme of, you know, who am I? Where am I? How do I find myself? Was a lot of this journey in search of yourself, and ultimately, was it something that you were able to find, or was it something that you realized, oh, wait, it's been there the whole time?
Yeah. Yes and yes and, you know, no and no. But so, yeah, I mean, the book starts in this point where my girlfriend of a couple of years, I call Sati in the book, we'd been planning this trip to India for over a year where we were going to go together. And then about a month before, we broke up, and that was mostly because she found someone else. And we were, who seemed to like basically trigger every one of my insecurities. And so there I was, you know, trying to figure out whether I would go on the trip at all. And all I really wanted was Sati back, but I decided I would still go. And a lot of being in India at the start was, I was telling myself it was about getting credentials for journalism school, and it was about all these other things. And it was really, I just wanted Sati. And I thought because she was there, maybe I would get a chance to win her back. But I mean, the book really jumps off at a point where I've sort of realized that she's not going to complete me. And I've ended up in the Himalayas, and I'm primarily because I'm just suffering so much. I just can't do anything, and everything is awful, and I'm trying to work and just down in the heat of India. And I wind up in the Himalayas near where the Dalai Lama lives. And just because I need something, and meditation has had been something that offered me solace in the monastery. And I'm like, I need to get something back that I've lost. And then through the course of finally, you know, doing some retreats and making friends up there, et cetera, I realized that what I am looking for is self, and what I've been looking for all along in pining after Sati is actually the wholeness that I've lost. But it, as always, I mean, in our desires, I think that's what all our desires are ultimately aiming at, whether we're looking for success and validation. It's like, well, what we're really looking for is like happiness and completeness, but, you know, we think we might get it in that sort of validation, external yeah. validation. And, you know, we learn that lesson over and over and over again, whether you don't get the thing and then you get a lot of suffering and you have to turn back to something more internal, or you get the thing and you're like, wait, I'm still here. I am still with all my, you know, baggage and problems, and this didn't solve it. So,
right. I mean, I just have had person after person come on the show from that perspective. I mean, the suffering side, not as frequently. I love your heartfelt story about this girlfriend. I mean, such a young 20-year-old too, like, right. Like, so heartbroken. But yeah, trying to feel like something in the external world is going to make us whole, only to find out that that doesn't happen. And so do you feel that that's something that we can learn and stop chasing after? Or is that just the human experience in your mind?
It's a great question. And I mean, I think that people solve this problem in the past often by, you know, leaving the world. And that's what I did in the Buddhist monastery, was like, well, you separate yourself from all the things that lead you to seeking achievements that are ultimately going to be dissatisfying. So you can become a monk, and in any tradition, or a nun, or a, you know, wandering philosopher, and if you were, you know, in the old Greek times or whatever, and basically just are like, oh, I'm done. Mm-hmm. Done with the rat race, putting it aside, and mm-hmm. I'm just going to focus on this internal process. But obviously that's not for a good portion of us. And for me, I think all our waves are water. I wanted to test this theory that, well, if it is all on some ultimate level one, and if we can find that internal wholeness by separating ourselves from the world, we should be able to find it in the world too. And obviously I'm not the first to think that, but so the model, I think, becomes one of, well, we have to go out and hunger for things and try to get respect at work and try our best and, you know, court our partners and try to be our best selves. You know, we're out there doing the world. This is how the world works. And somehow we need to be able to do those things while holding the results lightly and holding this sort of ultimate perspective that those things, those successes are not going to be the end all be all. And the model for that, I think, is one in which you're constantly holding paradox and you need a way to connect to the ultimate reality of things, the oneness piece in the midst of the hungering. And so it's very challenging and it's the, you know, it's the ultimate challenge of living. And I think from my experience, it is possible. And it's because we suffer and that we're reminded that this is necessary. So we have to find a way to hold this ultimate perspective, this perspective of oneness in the midst of the everyday hungers, you know, celebrations, letdowns. But to me, it's those letdowns and the suffering that we experience that every day, I mean, it's there every day, even if you're having a good day, that bring you back to remembering this ultimate perspective. And for me, my meditation practice is sort of the core of that. It's sort of the center of the circle where I have to come back to being able to get an inkling of this all our waves are water perspective. And then I can hold my desires a little bit more lightly, still celebrate when things go well, but then when, you know, also know that, like, well, this isn't going to last and, you know, there's going to be more obstacles and that's okay. And that every time there is an obstacle, it's a reminder to come back to the self in the big sense that is sort of beyond needing external validation.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I'm just like the oneness in the midst of hunger. I feel like I literally like ready to go on Twitter and put that up there. That's such a great quote. I appreciate that insight. And I really feel that so many people can resonate with this concept of, right, having that struggle and being in that struggle. And we don't want to go off grid and live, you know, outside of the lives we have, but how do we navigate the balance of connecting to ourselves and living our lives and not getting lost in that? You talk about the struggle is the joy. A lot of people would say the joy is the joy. The joy is, you know, having a cookie. Like it's not about struggle. So why do you equate struggle and joy?
Well, I think I first had this insight in a tangible way, surfing. And I surfing is a big part of my life, sort of the active way that I find that oneness piece. And I happen to live at San Francisco's Ocean Beach, where we get these just ridiculous wave patterns where there's, you just can't get through. You can't get out. A lot of places, there's a point break and you can kind of paddle around to get to where you want to ride the wave. Mm-hmm. But here, you have to just paddle through barricades of whitewash just to get to the point where you might get the joy, you know, the wave you're hoping to get. And sometimes it's, you know, 45 minutes and you're more in that long distance runner mode of your shoulders are burning, you're nauseous, you're, why did I do this? You know, and you get held down and, you know, sand in your nostrils. I remember one day I was out there and I think I'd been away for a while from the ocean and I was just happy to be out there. I was, you know, in one of these, not sure if I'm going to even make it out, which is always humbling. And I realized in the midst of it that I was loving it, you know, that I would rather be here than just about anywhere else. And even though I was experiencing a lot of, you know, physical pain, mm-hmm. It wasn't in like a masochistic, like, yeah, give me more pain. It was like, no, I just love this. I love that I get to be out here. And I thought if I could translate that to the struggles I experience that I always want to resist as like, you know, oh, I'm feeling fear, I'm feeling anxiety, I'm feeling, if I could sort of have that perspective of like, ultimately, I love life. And this, all these struggles in life are paddling for those moments when you're up on the hill with your, you know, celebrating a promotion or your marriage or whatever it is. It's like all the other stuff is the paddling.
Right. 90% of life, right?
Right. 99.9. And that's true of surfing, though. You always see these surfers who are out on the wave and in the tube, and you're like, wow, they must be having such fun. But they're working hard, you know, to get there. And but that's why we love it. That's why surfing is like this obsession that becomes a whole religion unto itself, is because it's challenging. And that's why people love it. If you were just given the wave on a silver platter and like, here, experience this, you'd be like, oh, that was cool. I got inside a little aqueous tunnel and it was neat. Wow. Like on to the next thing, you know, you wouldn't really, because the struggle is where we grow. And I think we're here to grow our brains, our hearts. We have this desire to evolve and learn. And so, you know, the joy is the joy.
Yeah.
And we should definitely enjoy that cookie, you know, to the fullest, but it's, if that's all, you know, we're going to be pretty miserable because, you know, 10 cookies in a row.
I know. We all think that's what we want, right? We all think, well, we just want endless rages, nothing but cash. Like, but that's not where you get the real fulfillment in life. It's from the struggle that gets you there. There's this great study that, you know, employees prefer appreciation over just money. Side note, but in my company, we decided one year we had a good year. And so we were like, let's just bring people in one by one, end of year, just tell them, this is how much cash we're giving you, like straight up in an envelope. My brother and I were so excited. We're like, this is going to be awesome. We didn't tie it to anything, right? We didn't let them know beforehand. We just showed up with money. You would think the place would be jumping for joy. But in fact, it was one of the most miserable experiences. Like people came in, they were anxious. They thought they were getting fired. Like we would break the news, like here is like whatever, $500 to several thousand dollars out of nowhere. And they just stared at us blankly, like, I don't get it. Right?
Like, totally.
What the hell?
I hear that. I mean, all day. And it's so interesting. I mean, we're just curious beings, and it's fascinating to study what pleasure is and what happiness is. A story I don't tell in the book that I often like to reflect on is this. I do talk about going to Bali in the book, but shortly after Saltwater Buddha, I like to stay in these little sort of bungalows in Bali that are like a dollar a night on this surf break, and just dirt floors, like, but you have everything you need. You have mango juice, you know, you have the waves, you have good friends, what have you, and
yeah.
It's where to be. And so I'd been there surfing for a few weeks, and then I happened to be invited to this writer's conference in Bali where they put you up at, you know, this place where Oprah stays, and it's infinity pool. And and I remember just the juxtaposition of being so excited on the first day, and increasingly by day seven, after getting the lavish breakfast again, I could not wait to get back to my little palapa. And I think it was partly because, not that it was bad at the lavish place, and I'm not against luxury, but it was interesting to watch how my state was kind of even and almost like could only go up on the palapas. But here it was like I was reminded, if I was having a bad day, that I shouldn't be. Because like, for if I was just having an average time, it was like I was surrounded by opulence, and all those opulent reminders were a reminder that, well, if I wasn't having a good time, it was my fault.
Okay, so you know Louis C.K. does like a whole skit in his new Netflix comedy routine on this. It's hysterical. Like he was miserable. He was like totally happy traveling the world for most of his career in really, really dumpy motels, but then he made it and he went to these great hotels, and he's like, I became a completely miserable human being because I needed everything to be perfect every day.
It's so true. And it's weird, and you don't believe it until you're experiencing it. And I mean, there's lots to be said for being able, though, to then enjoy, I think, when you do get a situation that's very fortunate.
And, yes.
And And that's like a practice unto itself almost, because there are all these triggers of ways where you can be like, well, whatever, this room service sucks. And now you're in a bad mood. And then you're like, who am I becoming? And, yeah. And it's like just trigger after trigger. But then to sort of, when you do stumble on something wonderful like that, to be able to be like, ah, well, you know, letting go of perfection, this is just another place to be grateful for. And it's almost like you have to sort of know how to approach that, because I think it is easier. I mean, Norway is supposedly, you know, the happiest place on earth. I don't know really if that's measurable, but they often say it's because, you know, they have, you know, among great healthcare, et cetera, just sort of, you know, they're not super, super ambitious, like, and a huge world player. So when there is like a little bit of success, or sort of you get on the scene a little more, it's like that bump is much better than sort of, if you're already like, we're America, we're number one, we have to always be number one, we have to be. Like, well, then it's like any little downgrade is just like misery. And so,
And in America, we're told we are entitled to, right, happiness and fulfillment. And so when we don't have it, we're like, this is totally unacceptable. I have to feel happy all the time, right? So I agree. And so you talk about celebrating and how important it is to celebrate that, you know, you're to your analogy, right? Like the pain of going out there, catching the wave and then catching it, but also letting go, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's somehow, again, this is the paradox coming back in, somehow, like I was saying, when you're at that great hotel and you've worked hard to get there, it's like celebrate it, you know, because if as soon as you get there and you're on to the next thing, one, you're just setting yourself up for that pattern of never being in the moment, never appreciating what you have. But and all the studies point to this, that if you do celebrate a little more when you get that achievement through struggle or whatever, you increase the amount of happiness, and you also are changing your brain, you know, to be able to receive more of that contentment. You're sort of like widening your container. But the flip side is that in that celebration, I think you can also be setting yourself up for like, well, it'll always be like this now. And it's like, well, no, it probably won't. And you're just, so to be able to celebrate that wave, you know, I remember when I got my first barrel, it's called, you know, when you get inside the wave, it's just like, it took me like a decade to even come close to doing it. God. I remember, you know, I got that perfect ride and I was so excited. And I thought, well, this will happen all the time now. It was like two more years before that happened again. And so it was, and I remember all of a sudden, you know, it was like I'd upped the ante for a quote unquote good surf session was, and for me to feel good about myself. And it was like, what a bummer if I'm clinging to that experience now and it has to all of a sudden be this thing that I get so much joy out of, has to be at a certain level. And so the letting go, I think, is equally, if not more important than the celebrating.
I love that. I love that. And you talked to something else that I'm very, very passionate about. It's this idea of never giving up, but at the same time, questioning your approach. I feel like so many entrepreneurs, I was interested in how this came up for you, but they, you know, they have this mindset, I've set my goal and I can never give up on my goal. And I mentor them a lot and I say, listen, you know, when the market gives you feedback, you want to like pivot on your goals, because, you know, just always grinding to a goal, it doesn't, sometimes you're just on the wrong track, right? You have to pivot a little bit and to know when to find the difference. So what does that topic mean for you? Where did this, you know, come from? And, you know, was it through surfing as well, or was it through other experiences?
I mean, it's through all experiences. Surfing is always an easy analogy because, again, to go back to Ocean Beach, you know, you're paddling. And like, I've had many experiences where just pure grit is what gets me there. And it's like, if you're not ready to grind, you're going to give up too easily. And so I think we always have to have that experience in writing a book, it's a grind. You know, there's like, you get the book deal and you're like, woo. And then you're like, oh, and I have to write it.
Right. And page like 60, you're like, wow, right. This thing's caving in on me.
And then you're like, you know, oh, I got 200 pages. Oh, and it's awful. It turns out it's awful. Now I have to like edit it and re-edit it and re-edit it. Uh-huh. And so it's, you know, you have to be ready to grind, I think, in any place, any endeavor worth doing that is going to, you know, help you achieve your dreams. That said, there are points where you have to check your approach. And if you're just head down grit, it's like, you know, that can also go badly and just be, and it's different for each situation, but because surfing is a simple one, I'll just use it that, you know, you've been paddling for an hour and you're about to throw up and you're not, you know, you're just getting into a dangerous territory where you're just not going to make it. You know, going back to the beach, looking at where other people have been successfully getting out, maybe you're in the wrong rip current and there's a place where you're just, you know, you can rest up. And literally, I mean, at our beach, you can walk down the beach 20 yards and be in a rip current that will take you right out. Mm. And so much is about life is timing and observation and, you know, acting at the smart time. So I think there's some balance in all things with writing. I think, you know, you get the idea, you get over your fears, you're ready to grind, but like, have you really assessed, you know, the marketplace? Are there 10 other books like this already out there where you're going to be, you know, what's your unique angle? So I think that's, you know, it's that mix of grit and just basic intelligence, I think, that come with never giving up. It's like, don't give up on your goal, but do, if you're just grinding, you know, assess, am I grinding without an intelligent approach? And I think the opposite can be true, right? With where you're just learning everything about the market, you know, about the market and assessing and hemming and hawing, and you're not just like ready to just, at some point you got to jump. But obviously each situation is different, but I think balancing those two is important.
Yeah. I just couldn't agree more. It's something that took me a long time. You're making me think of when I was scuba diving in my 20s, and one day I went out and I was kicking and kicking and kicking and kicking and staring down at a weed at the bottom of the ocean. And me and this weed just stared at each other. Like I was going nowhere. Like the current was so strong and this weed was just laughing at me. Like you can keep kicking, but you're not going to go anywhere. And it was just like, that was the wrong day. Like I, you know, it was so frustrating because it takes so long to get out with the scuba gear and everything, but the currents were just too strong. And so to recognize, you know, I kicked for a very long time, but there's a point where it's like, pack it up, go home, relax, you know, be kind to yourself.
Right. And I think it's with projects, I often find this where you just, you know, a project isn't working. And you're just like, I will not give up, you know, and then there's a point where it just becomes ridiculous because mm-hmm. it's not going anywhere. And that's when I think, you know, you pack it in and you say, okay, I'm not giving up on this. I'm surrendering it to, you know, my unconscious, to, you know, the universe, whatever, you know, practice you have. And so often I find that that project that I mean, this book was an example. So one of the chapters you might remember from when I'm in Indonesia, I actually wrote a lot of that when I was there, and I was going to write a novel about this character, one of my friends. And so I was using him as like a character study, but I was writing, and the novel ended up not working. I just couldn't get it, the narrative right. So I felt like a failure and I was miserable and I spent 6 months on that. And then, you know, when I came back around to the story and I realized I wanted to write about that time, I was like, oh, I have all this great stuff that is like a, you know, a journal, and I used it. But so no, I think no project ever goes wasted. It's not going to go as planned. I mean, you can bet on that.
Yeah. When I left entrepreneurship, I was like, oh my God, because I wanted to go on and do, you know, philosophy was my first love and really what I love. And like I spent all those years getting skills in something I don't care. But in fact, like to be an author today requires a very entrepreneurial spirit, and it's really helped me. So, you know, I think it's a great message and a great point. So I ask everybody who comes on this show, and I'd love to ask you and hear your view on it, but what does an authentic life mean to you?
I think it just means stopping what we're basically told to do through everything surrounding us, which is follow the likes, you know, look and compare yourself to others and then sort of try to fit into that. Instead, I think an authentic life means spending time. And it does take time. It takes a lot of trial and error, and it's the scary path, figuring out what you have to say, do, or that isn't about trying to get likes or trying to compare to, you know, the Flanders next door who have the great car. It's about, you know, at the risk of sounding a little cheesy, just following your own heart and why you're here. And I mean, it sounds hokey to say it, but I've experienced this in my own writing, and you can be close. You know, it was like with the Fear Project, it was a book where I did all this pop science research and I was writing. I felt like I was going through all the motions. I was like, I'm doing my passion. I have some surfing in here. I have, you know, all the things for the recipe, but there was something off about it. And it was that I'd looked at the marketplace and what other authors were doing and what a quote unquote successful book would need. And I was just plugging in the ingredients and I wasn't doing the listening part of why, what's my unique take on this whole life sauce. What a reader expects. It's like, if you're going to be writing, you know, it's like, give us all your wisdom. Don't just give us what, you know, the world has already told us regurgitated through you. It's like, we want your special sauce. And and so it's subtle, and you can be fooling yourself, I think, into thinking you're being authentic where you're not really not taking time to do the listening part. So,
and what do you do to listen? What's a practice that you have to tune into that? Because I think you're right. It's this very nuanced, subtle space that's, can toy with you and make you feel like I'm being so authentic, and it's totally not authentic at all, right? It's like authentically just like something you saw yesterday.
Right. It's, I mean, I think we need to unplug is the way that we listen, you know. I mean, you know your thing. If you have it, it's like you got to go hike for that hike where you put down your phone. You know, for me, I go out in the water and I do sitting meditation. But the key thing is that, you know, I put away my phone. I stop looking at what other people are liking in the social media world. And I think it takes more than that than we usually think. We're like, okay, I did my 20 minutes, you know, and it's like, yeah, good. But like, have you, you know, check out for, you know, a few days, a quarter, and go and be quiet, you know, and take time away from reading everyone else's stuff and really just, you know, listen. And it's it helps, I think, for me. I know I have sort of a mindfulness practice which helps, you know, be in those quiet places. And whether you have, you know, everybody has their own thing, but that's my experience. I need that. I need to unplug for a few days, a quarter, and otherwise I just will go crazy. But I also won't be authentic.
I love that you said do your own thing too, because I bring guests on and I ask them that question and everybody has answers. And lately it's dawned on me that it's very easy to start to compile all the answers from everybody and feel like, oh, okay, well, if they're doing that and they've been successful, I should do exactly that. And it's so important to get inspiration from the people that you hear or admire, but make sure it's something that really works for you, right? The reason people are doing it is because they find that peace, they find that calm. If it's for some people a walk or a hike, other people, you know, a meditation. Some people it's kickboxing, you know, like they just need to like really.
I hear you on that. And some people, it's like, they're like, I don't want to go be alone. I need to be with people and to be, you know, bantering. And that's how I find. And I think it's like, that's fine. I'm an introvert. So I'm like, I go be by myself. Yeah, you know, other people need something else. And you're right. It's like, if you're being authentic, then listen to that.
Yeah.
And and do that.
Well, Jamal, thank you so much for coming on, sharing this incredible story of this new work and all the thoughts behind it, all our waves, our water. If people are interested, they want to order the book, where can they find you, the book, more information?
Mm-hmm. The book is at jamalyogas.com, /all our waves. But, you know, anywhere books are sold, you can find it. And I'm on all the social media sites that I have to take breaks from.
Guys, it's a great book. He's an incredible writer. If you didn't listen to the intro, I mean, this is a guy who's been writing for years and years and years, really high quality prose and just a captivating story. Thank you, Jamal, for coming on and sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hey, before you go, I have a quick question for you. Have you ever considered coaching? If you have no idea what coaching is, no worries. It's basically like a personalized workout program, but instead of doing 100 squats and a million sit-ups, you're working out your mind, your well-being, and your emotions. Coaching is about setting goals and taking action to create a life that's meaningful to you. As we navigate through life and ask ourselves the tough questions, what do I want? What makes me happy? How do I build a life that works for me? Just like we talk about on the podcast, how do I have success, but have success that's authentic and meaningful? In part, the tactics play a huge role. Setting goals, having priorities that make sense, and making sure you're organized with your lists. After running a company for 15 years, I help my clients with that all the time. But coaching takes it even further. We remove all that stuff, all those mental obstacles that get in your way when you're trying to make those tough life choices. If that sounds interesting to you, come on over to lauraco.com, click on the contact form and send me a note, or at the bottom of the homepage, you'll see a button where you can click and set up a call with me. Just like that, it's free. We'll chat, we'll find out what's going on and see if it makes sense for me to help you out. No strings attached. I hope to hear from you. And again, thank you so much for tuning in. I really value each and every one of you.